easy. You can't take your ordinary ohmmeter and do this. As long as you get the contact resistance at all of these sliding points to be milliohms, you're going to have 100% efficient antenna. If you get a fraction of an ohm at any of those interfaces, you'll be amazed how fast it can chew up power and give you intermittent scratchy contacts and give you performance that changes from time to time. So please continue with these experiments, John. Don't be thoroughly discouraged by what I said. I'm just trying to tell you where I think the minefield is located, and don't want you walking into that minefield without knowing ahead of time what are the hazards, if you know what I mean. So please come back and tell us what you find. Next person on the list was Wes in 2XJN. And Wes, one of the things that I thought about, let me drop. Was a discussion you and I had a few days ago on loop antennas versus dipole antennas. Bear in mind now that every one of the antennas that we're likely to touch, with the exception of a Zomnik antenna and a Belbridge antenna, with those two exceptions, which are zillions of wavelengths long, when it comes to finite length antennas, less than two wavelengths in circumference and less than two wavelengths of length, when it comes to those kind of antennas, if it's a dipole-like structure, the energy is bouncing back and forth. There is a standing wave of resonant energy bouncing back and forth 10 or 20 times before it gets radiated on a dipole-like structure. In the case of a loop structure, I don't care if it's a tiny loop or a great big loop, every loop structure also has a standing wave. In this case, the standing wave is a little bit different. You could say there is a RF wave traveling in the clockwise direction around your loop. There is another RF wave traveling in the counterclockwise direction around your loop. Those two waves are equal in magnitude, equal in voltage, and they, because they're moving in opposite directions, create a standing wave. There are places where you could make measurements along your loop where you're going to find high voltages, other places where you're going to find low voltages. That's what a standing wave does. Very similar to what you find when you're looking for a standing wave in the middle of your slotted line structure. The slotted line has a signal going from top to bottom and from bottom to top. If your slotted line is, you know, vertically, so to speak. If the slotted line is laying east to west, you have a wave going from east to west, you have a wave going from west to east, and the way they mix together gives you a standing wave. You move the probe on the slotted line to find places, let me drop it. You find places in that slotted line where the voltage is maximum, you find places where the voltage is minimum. The ratio between the two, we call it the standing wave ratio. By the same token, on your loop antenna, once you set it up, depending on how many wavelengths it is in diameter, with the right kind of instrumentation, and maybe something as simple as a neon bulb held near it on the end of a wooden stick, you'll find that there are places where the voltage is maximum along the loop, there are places where the voltage is minimum along the loop. There is a clockwise going wave, a counterclockwise going wave. They create a standing wave on every loop antenna you and I are likely to build that really radiates, because every one of our antennas is a standing wave resonant structure, resonant standing wave structure. That's how we radiate. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Interesting. I have had a discussion with John about this subject, although, again, somebody interrupted us with that and we moved to another frequency. And his point was very much similar to the one that you represent. I don't have a problem with that. I had a problem with the third Newton's law and the violation of the third Newton's law when we talk about action, interaction, and vectoral mathematics in regards to the antenna, the loop antenna or balance antenna. They don't need counterpoint or counteraction whatsoever. So that was my problem. And you said, no matter how you try, you have a problem with that, applying the third Newton's law to that. Now it looks like I don't have much problem. Let me up. Because we have a first hour, I don't want to go to the scientific discussion right now. And I do very much appreciate that you pick up the transformer subject. But I would like to point the attention of the audience. I have material for the first hour, which is about a main Navy antenna structure and 2 million watt transceiver working on the frequencies of 24 kilohertz and 17.8 kilohertz. And the question is, before that, I go shortly to how the antenna looks like. Each area consists of a ring of 13 tall metal masts connected at the top to a network of horizontal cables. The cables consist of 6 diamond-shaped panels radiating from the center tower in hexagonal pattern shaped like a snowflake. The two areas normally operate together as one antenna, but each is designed to function independently to allow maintenance on the other array. The central tower of each antenna system is 204 meters, which would be 997 feet tall, and is surrounded by 6 875 feet tall masts placed on rig with a radius of 556 meters, that would be 1,500 feet, around the central tower. The remaining 6 towers of the array are 799 feet tall and placed on the circle of 975 meters, which would be 3,070 feet around the central tower. Now, question.
Stand by, Wes. You said you're not going to go into a deep scientific study, and you're going into a deep scientific study. You're violating your own words, Wes. I'm going to bypass you for now. We're going to come back to this one. John signed in, Jim signed in, KC2BHY. Jim, I think you had a question. Go right ahead. Go ahead, Jim.
I apologize for the late check-in.
You've got it, Jim. I hope the antenna you normally hold in front of you, if you hold it in the right position so we can hear you continuously, find a good spot and go right ahead with your question or comment. You got it, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Dick.
Jim, we only heard one word from you. I wonder if anyone else closer to Jim was hearing him on the input and can tell us what Jim said. We only heard one word, and we heard nothing else. KC2BHY, KC2RIW in the segment. Maybe you've got to move to another position now, Jim. What I think you should really do with that beautiful antenna of yours is put a string on the tip of it, hang it from the ceiling of whatever room you're in so that it's in one fixed position and high up with the transmission line going down to your handy-talky. And if you find that one position and you keep operating that way, we'll hear you with good signal. Oh, back to you, Jim. KD2BHY, KD2RIW.
Yeah, sorry, my HD's running out of battery here. That was the problem. Sorry about that. I should change the battery. I
just
had a question. Sorry about that.
Twice I heard you say you've got a question, but I haven't heard anything else, but Jim.
Sorry, my HD's running out of battery here. I'll ask the question next.
Yeah, it's too bad you don't have a pair of charged batteries. Mr. AOT, I think you wanted to add something. Go right ahead.
Yeah, sorry, Dick, but... Wes, the spent a long time premising the, or prefacing his discussion. I'm sorry, but, you know, he was kind of discounted really quickly. I just thought that he didn't get a fair shake for an answer. Over.
I do agree, you're definitely right, Dennis. He did not get a fair shake. Week after week, John and I make a virtual promise, and for people who sign in during the first hour, we make a sincere effort to give everyone a brief answer during the first hour. And when we get into something like the J-pole antenna, which can be highly misunderstood, I went a little bit more than a deep question because I thought it was worthy. When it comes to the deeper subjects with a much longer preamble and much longer discussion, we hold that for the second couple of hours of the segment. So, I was getting a very vague picture of an extremely elaborate structure that Wes was beginning to describe to us, and it didn't fall under the category of a brief question. I'll admit I treated him unfairly. We're going to come back to him. He's going to get his turn just a little bit later. John, I think it's time we go to the mailbag. KC2WGB, what kind of mail do we have this week? K2LAW and the Tech Man.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick. Everybody's on the net. Yes, over the past couple of weeks, we had several discussions, and we got some questions on it. So let me let it track, and we'll go to the first one. Okay, 2 weeks ago we were talking about microwave ovens, and you brought up a couple of good topics, and one of them, this young gentleman, noticed that you said originally the microwave ovens were operating at lower frequencies than the 2.4 gigahertz. Okay, his question is, if they were operating on lower frequencies, because of the energy content, did it take longer to cook the same amount of food with the same amount of power? So maybe you can give me some info on that, Dick. Thank you, Dick. Please, you too, WGB.
Very fine, John. Sound good, logical question. And the answer is no. The way a microwave oven works, at least the ones that we have today, and they're not too different from the ones that the Percy Spent made at the, I think about the Amana division of Raytheon Corporation way back in the late 40s or 50s, I guess it was, when the microwave oven was invented. And you go to Google the word microwave oven and who invented it, you find out that Percy Spence supposedly was working on high-power microwave Klystron tubes at the Raytheon Corporation. And the story is that the chocolate bar in his pocket melted while he was standing near the tube. And he assumed the microwave was doing it. And I think this is an extremely good-sounding urban myth story that sounds logical, but my experiments lead me to believe it might not be true. But let me show you what's going on here. Let me drop. The way a microwave oven works is that you've got a sealed chamber, which is very well shielded from the outside world, where you open up the door, you put your food in there, you close the chamber. That chamber is an extremely highly conductive six-sided box. And the microwave tube, whether it be a Klystron, magnetron, or whatever, it doesn't matter, puts something close to a kilowatt of energy, 700 watts, 600 watts of energy, into that chamber by way of a probe. It's like if you've ever seen a waveguide, the coax adapter, where the coaxial connector at one side has a probe that goes into the piece of waveguide. Well, the side of the microwave oven has a probe, which usually has a plastic cover over it. You can't easily see it, but it's there in the upper right-hand corner of your microwave oven. And for the most part, there is no magic frequency. As long as your particular tube puts out that amount of power into that chamber, and that power is now going to bounce back and forth between those six walls and set up an extremely elaborate standing wave three-dimensional structure. If your eyes could see the radio wave, or in other words, if I had what would be an extremely interesting experiment, frequency to take roughly 1,082 neon bulbs and hang them on little threads so that they completely filled up the volume inside the microwave oven. I'm assuming now that my neon tubes can take the power, and maybe I have to cut back the power in my microwave oven to the point where I've got 1,000 neon tubes hanging in the three-dimensional space inside my microwave oven, and I'm looking through the transparent screen door when the microwave oven is running. What I would see is a whole bunch of places in the three-dimensional space where the neon tubes are bright and dim. There'd be a whole bunch of standing waves, and the Lazy Susan turntable on the bottom normally takes your food and rotates it in that magnetic field. Well, there's another whole design of microwave ovens where above the ceiling of the microwave oven, there is a great big fan blade that you don't see. It's above the false ceiling, the fiberglass ceiling, and that blade slowly rotates so that the standing wave structure moves. With reference to the food, you want the hot spots and the cold spots that are in the three-dimensional standing wave of that microwave oven. You want those hot spots and cold spots to propagate through your food as the food is moved or as the standing wave is moved. You want to drop? Because if you didn't do that, the leg of your turkey would be burned, and the body of the turkey would be raw, if you know what I mean. Because the body is sitting at the standing wave well, and the leg is sitting at the standing wave peak, and one is cooking and the other is not. So the local strength of the radio wave, because of the standing wave, because the wave is bouncing back and forth, there are places in space where the wave going from north to south and the wave going from south to north, there are places in that three-dimensional space where those two waves are in phase. You and I would call this a peak of field. There are places where the two waves are out of phase, where there's a cancellation, a null, and you get very little energy in that place at all times. Okay. Once I've chosen the frequency, once I've chosen the way of feeding it, and I've chosen the number of watts, if I'm running 900 watts of, let me pick the number, 27 megacycles, at my microwave oven number one, I've got microwave oven number two, where I'm putting in the same number of watts, but it's operating at 900 megs. Microwave oven number three, I'm putting in the same number of watts, and it's operating at 2.4 gigs. And microwave oven number four, I'm putting in the same number of watts, and it's operating at 4.5 gigs. Because the number of watts I put into the chamber are the same in my four examples, assuming my food has the same rate of absorption, whether it's a turkey that's got a lot of water or a turkey that's kind of dry, it's going to be a little bit of differences as a function of frequency minor. But the RF energy I'm putting in that microwave oven is bouncing back and forth until something absorbs it. If you've done it just right, the only thing that's absorptive is your glass of water, your cup of tea, or your hamburger or whatever. The food you put in the microwave oven is whether the RF energy has to pass through the food 3 times to be absorbed, or 30 times to be absorbed, or 300 times to be absorbed.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Whether that RF energy has to pass through your food 3, 30, 300, or 3,000 times doesn't matter. It's conservation of energy. If I'm putting 700 watts into that microwave oven, and I've got things running in such a way that most of that energy is not coming back to the tube, it's staying in the oven, and it's bouncing between those lossless walls, and the only thing that's absorbing it is the food I put into the oven. The bottom line is I'm putting 700 watts of heating RF energy into that food. And the food doesn't give a darn about whether or not you do it at 27 megs, 900 megs, 2.4 gigs, or 5 gigs. It isn't until you get up to 24 gigahertz that you have the first resonance of water molecules. We're not talking about resonance here. We're talking about dielectric heating. Dielectric heating takes place because the water molecule is a bipolar molecule. It's a polar molecule. You could say it acts like a dumbbell. The right-hand side of the dumbbell is positive, the left-hand side is negative. What's really going on is you've got water is H2O. The two hydrogen atoms are sitting at one end, 110 degrees apart, and the oxygen is at the other end. One end is positive, one end is negative. The water molecule on each half of the RF cycle is flipping back and forth following the RF energy. It's the flipping back and forth, and the fact that these water molecules are continuously crashing into each other, that as they crash together and they're flipping, they end up with more energy coming out of the bounce than went into the bounce because of the combination of the flip and the bounce. Let me drop. Because the twisting and bouncing is taking place similar to the so-called ping-pong paddle effect, where if I'm moving the ping-pong paddle towards the ball as it's coming toward me, the ball will leave my paddle at a greater velocity than it entered my paddle. That's the ping-pong paddle effect. That's what you get with the water molecule. So the individual water molecules by that process in the microwave oven are being speeded up in real velocity, real speed. Velocity of a molecule is what your thermometer measures, and you and I call it temperature. If they're moving faster, they're hotter. If they're hotter, the food is being cooked. So you put the same number of watts into that microwave oven, no matter what frequency, if it's operating correctly, you're going to get the same amount of heating of the food with very small difference because, yes, some foods have a slightly different dielectric constant than a high frequency versus a low frequency. That's a secondary effect. If I'm putting 700 watts into that oven, I'm going to get 700 watts of heating of that food when it's running correctly. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, very good. Well, I understand why he asked the question, because as he goes on here, he said that the flipping back and forth of those polar elements, the rate at which they flip back and forth, should have to do with how much, how fast they create heat. That's what he's saying. So he thought it would take longer at a lower frequency. Makes a little sense.
Yes, it does make sense. However, the rate at which the molecules are bouncing and hitting each other, the rate at which they're flipping, are very different rates. Water molecules at room temperature move average of 640 meters per second. I'm not sure of the exact distance, but I'm going to guess there's something in the vicinity of 3 nanometers of distance between the water molecules. 3 nanometers, 3 × 10⁻⁹ meters of distance between the water molecules, and they're moving at 640 meters per second on average at room temperature of water. You go through the mathematics of that, and I think they're crashing into each other at around 10 billion times per second. Very high number. So the crashing into each other is a major factor. The fact that they're being twisted at all is creating increased energy after the bounce as opposed to before the bounce. The fact that you're putting, maybe because of the lower frequency and the slightly different dielectric constant, the slightly different rate of the twist. Let me drop. Maybe the amount of absorption of the radio wave at the lower frequency is a little bit less, and therefore, the radio wave has to bounce more times before the water finally absorbs it. But the bottom line is the same. It's a conservation of energy situation. The walls of the oven are going to run ice cold because they're highly conductive and lossless. The air inside the microwave oven isn't doing anything. The only thing that's in there is your food, your cup of water, your tea, your turkey leg, your hamburger, whatever. And you're putting 700 watts from the microwave oven continuously into that oven, and it's got nowhere else to go. So as you change the frequency, I'm going to agree, there is a slight difference in the rate of absorption. The bottom line of that is the signal has to bounce 30 times or 300 times. Does it matter? The bottom line is when it's finished bouncing, the same amount of absorption of watts of energy is going into that food. You see what's going on there, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Coming. Yes, I do, Dick. In a way, it's a little counterintuitive, but I understand. I didn't know for sure myself. And now that you've explained it, yeah, that makes sense. Maybe there is a slight difference, but if we have the exact same quantity of food, same substance, and the same amount of wattage, basically we're going to be close in the time. to reach the same temperature with the element that we put in there. I believe Wesley had a comment on this. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, before I pick up West, let me drop for a second. Now, this phenomenon that I'm talking about, conservation of energy, has got a really nasty side effect. Let's assume that somebody has handed you a piece of Tupperware, and in the original package, it said that the blue one was microwavable, and the white one was not microwavable. This is what the original package said in your Tupperware, in my theoretical experiment. And you lost those packages, you lost those instructions, you don't know which is which. So, logically, you would first put the blue one in the microwave oven and run for a while and see if it gets hot. Then you would put the white one in the microwave oven and see if it gets hot. Bad test. In order for that test to be reasonable, you'd have to put a glass of water in there as a standard load. Then you'll find out which one is the microwave Tupperware and which one is not. But the glass of water is a standard load. The so-called microwavable blue one, in my example, will run ice cold. The white one that's not microwavable will run warm. You'll see a definite difference when there is a glass of water in there. Without the glass of water doing a standard amount of absorption, because of the conservation of energy problem, the so-called microwavable Tupperware with nothing in it, no food, is going to be subjected to 300 bounces before it absorbs, whereas the non-microwavable will be 10 bounces before it absorbs, but both will absorb the same amount of energy. You'll get a false alarm. You'll think that the microwavable one with no load in the oven runs hot, and you'll say it's not microwavable. You've got to have a standard load in there. You've got to fox the so-called conservation of energy problem. Now you can tell the difference. And when you're really using the Tupperware, let me drop it. When you're really using the blue one, which is known to be microwavable in my example, you're really putting something in that piece of Tupperware, the blue Tupperware. You're going to put your soup or your tea or your cereal or whatever you want to heat up. There's going to be real food that's absorbing inside of the blue piece of Tupperware. So you can't test something if the microwavable blue Tupperware was really as high in quality as you think it is, so that it has almost no absorption, it'll still run warm if the oven is thoroughly empty, and the oven will think it's empty, there's no absorption in there, you're putting in 700 watts, it's got to go somewhere, the only place left for it to go is back into that probe that fed the energy from the magnetron tube into the oven. It's now going to go back to the probe, back into the microwave magnetron tube, and now you're asking that tube to absorb an extra 700 watts of energy, and you may have just lost that tube. You may have pushed it beyond the spec limit. With rare exception, most of our microwave ovens will have a danger sign inside of the owner's manual telling you never to run it open. And if you put very high quality microwavable material in the oven and nothing else, no real food to absorb, then the oven will electronically think it's empty and you could damage it. If you had a question about this, Wes, N2XJN, K2LIW.
I have a statement. I have in front of me scientific papers that based on the electric hysteresis, the electric losses, then in different time domain analysis, heat transfer, microwave heating in the oven, permittivity and temperature distribution, they were able to deliver in the paper that I have in front of me a correct algorithm allowing through the combined electromagnetic and thermal procedure to take into the account the influence of the temperature on the electrical properties of materials. And they say in here about temperature dependence of the complex permittivity ruled by degree, a relaxation equation, and they created relativistic model, and they validate that model, and they prove that based on those properties, including the finite differences of time domain, FT squared TD method, the wavelength does matter, and it's critical. Thank you, John.
KD2AM.
For me, any frequency, any frequency. Doesn't matter whether you assign it to the microwave or anything else. I've read that the world of the microwave is not trivial, less loss, lossless. It depends from the frequency that you use and how you tune that structure. And when you take the sine wave, and the sine wave has a frequency of 82 megahertz or 10 megahertz. Now you compare that frequency and then power to 2.4 gigahertz. Now you go to the peaks and valleys, which is the energy the maximum. And then you spread it through the enclosed space, which would be the Faraday cage, in this point, the microwave, you will see that they don't cover. That means you can make it fan, you can try to turn it to food, whatever you want, or you can have a fan behind the plastic, but you would not be able to make it work as well if you have the frequency too low and too high.
Because you're trying to set up a standing wave in the microwave oven, and because you want the microwave oven to be some reasonable number of cubic feet when it's located in the kitchen or on your kitchen counter, nobody in his right mind is going to build a microwave oven at 2 megacycles, because in order to make it work correctly, it would probably have to be a chamber that's 10 feet high and 5 feet wide and 5 feet deep, so to speak. It wouldn't be practical. The nice thing about 24 or 50 megacycles is they're somewhere around 4.5-inch wavelength, and our microwave oven is multiple times 4.5 inches in at least 1, 2, or 3 of its dimensions. Therefore, the multiple standing waves in there, and as long as you can move the food on a lazy Susan, you're going to be waving the hot spot and cold spot through the tube, and after multiple rotations, you're going to get reasonably even heating. So now, once you've got enough standing waves in the microwave oven, because you've got a high enough frequency and a big enough number of wavelengths of the chamber, let me drop. And now you rotate the food so that you're translating it the right number of inches, so that all those hot spots and cold spots are going through every piece of your food, then you get reasonable heating, even heating. And then, whether or not the particular food has a higher or lower loss tangent at 2 gigs versus 4 gigs, but those are the two frequencies you want to operate your microwave oven at, is a rather secondary effect, because if I'm putting 700 watts in at 2 gigs and 700 watts in at 4 gigs, and if the food is more lossy at one of those frequencies than the other, it means the number of times the signal bounces in that Gaussian surface chamber is going to be different, but still the bottom line, if you believe in conservation of energy, is the same. If I put 700 watts into that chamber, and if it doesn't come back to the microwave tube, and there's nothing in the chamber but your food, you're going to be put 700 watts of heating energy into your food. And once you've decided you're putting 700 watts into the food, whether you do it at 2 gigs or 4 gigs, makes very little difference. Even though the chart is showing you a difference in dielectric constant and a difference in loss tangent, when you set up the chamber correctly, those variables become almost wiped out. I know that Dennis wanted to say something of it. KD2AOC, K2LIW, go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. Listen, we can have the conversation about 700 watts, and we could have how it works. One of the major things that you really need to understand is you don't want to put plastic in a microwave. What happens when you put the takeaway Chinese food in the microwave is it leaches all the toxins of the plastic into the food. You want to put glass or Pyrex, not plastic. Over.
Yeah, which is the instant thing is, yeah, I agree with what Dennis is saying on that one. There are kinds of plastic that have some really nasty chemicals in them. And even your water bottle was made out of plastic. Maybe you like drinking hot water, and you take your bottled water and put it in the oven. I don't recommend that. So I'm going to agree with Dennis on this one. You heat up plastics in an ordinary oven or a microwave oven. In either case, they're likely to outgas toxic substances into your food, and that's not good. There are kinds of Tupperware that at one time supposedly didn't do that. Whether or not it's still true today is an interesting question to discuss. I know that this is only question number one of what you received today, John. KC2WGD, K2RIW, go ahead.
You're right, Dave. KC2WGD. Okay, the next one is a much easier question. Let me let it drop. Okay, Dick, I have a young gentleman who repairs audio amplifiers, and he's running a low-budget show. He rebuilds over 50 times, and he notices in there they have some of these tubular wax-type capacitors, 0.047s, 0.01s, and he would like to know, being that they're audio amplifiers, is there any problem with substitution? He understands voltages, like going higher with the voltage is okay, but he's wondering if he were to change one of those say a 0.01 tubular wax capacitor with a disc capacitor with the same value of 0.01. Is that critical? Does it make a difference? What should he look out for? And is he okay doing that type of substitution in an audio amplifier? Maybe you can help Matt on that one day. KC2WGB, back to you.
I think the answer is no problem. The disc ceramic capacitors we use today, which are a result of some very interesting material studies, barium tetratitanate, for instance, is a material that has a dielectric constant of 100. There's some very fancy ceramic-like materials. The ATC company today makes some very high-quality microwave capacitors out of these fancy ceramic materials. Because of fancy ceramic materials, we have available today disc ceramic capacitors that are much, much smaller in overall volume, very different in physical appearance, very high in performance, very high in longevity. In roughly 1950, we'll say, the best kind of a 0.01 or 0.1 microfarad capacitor you could get your hands on in those days with the available material was a wax-type paper capacitor. And in those days, they were good enough, but they did tend to eventually give you leakage downrange and failure mechanism. So, with rare exception, I believe that a disc ceramic capacitor of the same number of microfarads and the right voltage rating is likely to give you no trouble today when you substitute it for that great big wax capacitor of the old days. There's one exception to that. Let me drop. And that is some of these ceramic capacitors are piezoelectric. As you put voltage across them, they change their physical dimensions. Some of those capacitors in a very high power audio amplifier might sing. If they're up against the chassis, it might give you a vibration sound. Also, there's a certain kind of oil-filled capacitor they've often used for the filter network on each of the line replaceable units on military boxes that go into an Air Force airplane. And that filter network, that's where you put in the 110 volts or the 240 volts, that filter network, when you simply switch over from the old-fashioned oil-filled metal-cased capacitors over to the new modern ceramic capacitors, because of the way they behave under transient conditions, when you get a sudden inrush of high current, the ceramic capacitor and its piezoelectric effect could give you some problems. But those are very rare, unusual situations where you're going to have this humongous power supply on a great big B-1 bomber airplane, which zillions of kilowatts comes out of that generator that's mounted on those four engines that can each make 36,000 pounds of thrust. I mean, the horsepower there is just, you know, billions of horsepower. But when that as a power supply is supplying you the voltage to your particular box, suddenly close the switch where this micro-ohm thrust impedance generator is capable of giving you an inrush current that I have measured as high as 5,000 amperes. And you put 5,000 amperes of inrush current through a ceramic capacitor, there's a slim possibility the piezoelectric effect will cause a physical noticeable change in the dimensions of that capacitor so that it literally shatters. So,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
So there are a couple of rare situations where a modern ceramic capacitor might not be the right thing, but with rare exception, I think you're going to be a hell of a lot better off and not to worry. On top of that, your audio amplifier, if you get it wrong, it's not going to explode, it's not going to catch on fire. You're going to test it thoroughly on the bench as you put in the new capacitor. There's all kinds of good ways you confirm that it's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. You put on a test record, so to speak, or a test tape, or you know what I mean, modern-day equivalent, a DVD that's giving you a bunch of test tones, and you find out how well your amplifier is behaving. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Coming.
Go ahead, Wes. Don't make it too long if you can help it.
Try to I'm still learning English to this point. Well, I'm thinking about changing the capacity, you can say, changing to ceramic capacitor. 100 microfarad is really pushing the limit for ceramic capacitor. So if the voltage is low, like a few volts to 10 or maybe 20 volts, the power link is portable, ceramic may be reasonable. But high-capacitance ceramic cups have their own set of advantages and disadvantages. The advantages are much lower equivalent series resistance and much higher ripple current capability, which is sensible usefulness for the higher frequency. Less heat sensitivity, much better lifetime, and in most cases, better mechanical richness. But they have problems. The capacitance can degrade with the voltage and denser, more energy storage per volume. And they also have the piezoelectric effect, which is called microphonic. And in the wrong places, this can lead to the oscillation. There is also another thing. When you're talking about the series and parallel equivalent resistance, it differs much more from the tantalum or for the electrolytic. If they are used for the power supply, ceramics are usually better than electrolytic, unless you need much more capacity. Talking about the ripple current, or heat absorbs in this different story, but those are the factors. Thank you.
You have to support the resistance.
Yeah, Brad, Wes did bring up one of the points that I'm vaguely remembering now, that certain kinds of ceramic capacitors, depending on the DC voltage you put onto them, they do have an effect where the equivalent capacitance increases or decreases as a function of applied DC voltage. And once in a while, if it's part of a resonant circuit, or if it's a critical capacitor where you're looking for a certain number of microfarads because it's part of the filter network, that could give you some grief. Most of the time when we're using ceramic capacitors, we're using them as either a bypass capacitor, where in that case all you want to make sure is it has the right minimum capacitance, and if it's got more than that, you don't care. Or it can use as a filter capacitor, as long as it's got the right minimum, you don't care. So in certain circumstances, test ceramic capacitors as a tuning element for a critical filter. You might want to read the spec sheet a little bit more carefully to be sure it's going to fit your particular requirement. And by the way, one of the things that was discussed on the TechNet about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, one of the questions that John was brought was that a guy was analyzing an audio oscillator. Let me drop. And it was probably the equivalent of a Hewlett-Packard Model 200 audio oscillator. That particular product in the late 50s put the Hewlett-Packard company in Palo Alto, California on the map. That little one-car garage in Palo Alto where Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard came together and with just simple resistor capacitor network gave you a very high accuracy, pure sine wave output audio oscillator for testing audio circuits in its day. That was the state of the art. You look at that particular oscillator, and you'll find out that in the cathode of the oscillating tube, you have a light bulb, a 110-volt light bulb, that's being fed about 10 volts. Not 110 volts, 10 volts. You say to yourself, what in the world is that light bulb doing? And that light bulb is serving an extremely critical capacity. It is a very accurate, rapidly changing variable resistor that has a 12-to-1 resistance ratio. You take a 100-watt light bulb, for instance, and you know that in order for it to draw 100 watts when you're putting 100 volts into it, I'm rounding off the numbers, it must draw 1 ampere. Let me drop it. Just under working conditions, it must be a 100 ohm resistor. 100 volts, 1 ampere, 100 watts, it's a 100 ohm resistor. When it's ice cold, it is less than 1/10 of that. You put your ohm meter across the 100 watt light bulb, and you'll measure something like 10 ohms. And you do the calculation, you'll say, whoa, if I put that across 110 volts, it's going to draw 10 amps. 10 amps at 100 volts, I'm going to be putting 1,000 watts into this thing. And the answer is yes. For the first few instants, you are putting 1,000 watts into that 100 watt light bulb. That tungsten filament changes very rapidly in resistance as a function of applied voltage because it's going up to 2,400 degrees Kelvin is the way it gives off light. And it goes into a very high resistance in the process of doing it. When you put that into the cathode of an oscillating circuit, or in the case of a modern-day operational amplifier, it's in the grounded lead, the negative lead of the op-amp, or in the case of a transistor, it's in the emitter or the drain, so to speak. It's doing a very critical operation. Let me drop. And that is to make a pure sine wave oscillator. Like every oscillator, your oscillator consists of an amplifier with a feedback loop. The feedback loop usually contains a filter network that favors some particular frequency you want the oscillator to run at. And the total loop gain from output back to input through the feedback filter network must have a gain of unity. And when I say unity, I mean 1.00000 as far as the zeros you want to carry. Why that exact number? If it was 0.99999 instead of 1.000, the oscillation would slowly decrease and it would stop. If the gain in the loop was 1.00001, a little bit bigger than 1 instead of 1, the oscillation would continuously increase, and pretty soon your beautiful sine wave oscillator is making square waves because you've now increased the amplitude to the point where your amplifying device, no matter what it is going into voltage limit, current limit, crossover distortion, something. It's going to give you a very non-sinusoidal wave. If you want a pure sinusoidal oscillator, you must force the circuit electronically to find 1.0000 of loop gain. The highly changing variable resistance of that light bulb does that for you. When the oscillation starts building up too big, the voltage on the light bulb gets larger, the resistance goes up, the feedback impedance changes, the amount of signal being fed back changes, and the oscillation goes back down again. The bulb automatically adjusts that. Beautiful circuit. But the issue is Mr. Packard. When they invented that particular combination, let me drop it. For a simple resistive capacitive network to give you a very precisely adjustable frequency, very pure sine wave of exactly the right amplitude, the combination of the Weinbridge circuit as the oscillator and that light bulb as a automatic gain control, that has the elegance of simplicity, a really sophisticated circuit. And when you look at it, you say, how can something that simple be that good? If you take a look at the Electronic Design News, December 2012, page 9, you'll see a picture of what I'm talking about. Electronic Design News, December 2012, page 9. You'll see a schematic of an oscillator that does what I'm describing. You build that particular oscillator with those components of your substitutes, and you put it on your oscilloscope. You'll say, wow, that's the purest sine wave I have ever seen. How the hell does it do that? and by very easily adjusting those resistor and capacitor values, you can make that thing run anywhere from 10 hertz to 10 megacycles, whatever you desire. And it'll give you exactly the right amplitude of the purest sine wave you've ever seen. Ordinarily, that's an extremely difficult thing to do. But I pass it on because it's something I ran into and something we discussed a couple of weeks ago, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the tech man.
Oh, very good, Dick. Yes, I'm sure that was an interesting article. I don't know how in-depth it was, but, yeah, there is a lot there. And by the way, the gentleman has repaired that, and it is working perfectly. And all it was the light bulb. And I think he paid $12 for a dish. So it's kind of a good deal. Let me let it drop. And by the way, I agree with you 100% on the capacitors and an audio amplifier. And as long as he does his square wave testing and everything seems to be okay, I don't think he has any issues at all with that. I don't think there's any safety issues. And if he has a problem with them breaking up or going into the piezoelectric, I'm sure that'll be revealed in his testing. So I agree. All right, let me hear the drop. I'm going to the last one. PC2WGB. Hi, Dick. I have a gentleman who's using a 75-watt lamp and a 60-watt lamp for tuning up his transmitters. Now, he'd like to know, is there any way that can damage it? He doesn't have a dummy load, and he's another one operating on a very low budget. Do you think that's okay to do? And he's heard about it being done before. He's using tube equipment, not solid state. He knows it was done years ago with amps. What do you think of it, and any recommendations for him? Back to you, Dick.
Most tube amplifiers have a real high network output tuning circuit in the final stage of tube amplifier. As such, that tube amplifier circuit with that high network is extremely adaptable. In most cases, at most of the phase angles, that will tolerate from probably a 10 ohm load up to a 300 ohm load, what is called a 50 ohm transmitter. Properly readjust the tuning loading control that most of the bands you operate on, that thing is very adaptable. And so, when you put on whatever light bulb you like, and you adjust those controls to give you the best power output, the best light on the light bulb, would you damage the transmitter? Tubes are amazingly forgiving. Yes, if you had the tank circuit, you twist the tuning and loading capacitors, but so far that it's way out of resonance. Where now, as you push down the key in the CW mode, the plate of the tube starts glowing, and you stay there for long periods of time, you would artificially age the tube. But for any reasonable length of time of testing, the tube is extremely forgiving. You do this with a solid-state amplifier without an antenna tuner, and life is a lot more complicated. It's nowhere near as tolerant. But tube amplifiers, they can tolerate a lot. And so, whether you use a 100-watt bulb, a 60-watt bulb, or a 30-watt bulb, almost doesn't matter, assuming you're testing it at the 30-watt level and the 100-watt level. And by the way, if you've got a 100-watt bulb and you're testing a 50-watt transmitter, don't worry. Yes, the bulb is not going to come up to full brilliance, but still, because of the adaptability of that Pi network, you can make a good match most of the time. And if you don't get a good match, in some cases, you just change the length of the transmission line between the transmitter and the light bulb. That will rotate the phase of the repeater. If your particular light bulb at your particular frequency is not a good 50 ohm match, then most of the time it won't be. So therefore, with that light bulb in the circuit, you're going to get a finite amount of standing wave ratio. That's a fancy wave thing. You're going to get some reflected energy from the light bulb most of the time. Not necessarily bad when you drop. So even if you're tuning and loading control on your Pi network, the loading control in particular runs out of range for your particular light bulb at your level of testing, you don't have to give up yet. Change the length of the coaxial cable in between the transmitter and the light bulb, add another eighth wave or a quarter wave length of cable, you now will be rotating the phase angle of number, 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, where under one particular test, the light bulb will look like a 100 ohm load, because it's got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio to your 15 ohm transmitter, and you add another quarter wavelength of cable between the transmitter and the light bulb, what used to be a 100 ohm load just became a 25 ohm load. It becomes an impedance inversion. 25 ohms on a 50 ohm transmitter is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. You didn't change the standing wave ratio. You changed the phase angle of the reflected signal. You moved to the opposite side of the Smith chart. What used to be 100 ohms just became 25 ohms. And somewhere in between in the length of the cable, you can have it slightly inductive or slightly capacitive. By choosing the right length of cable, you probably will take out of range tuning of the loading control on your Pi network and bring it back in range. So light bulbs are a beautiful way of testing your transmitter. The world's best dummy load, because you get a beautiful visual feedback. You don't have to worry about cooling the oil and running it for only a certain length of time before the dummy load becomes overheated. The light bulb continuously radiates that energy as light into the room. And except for the fact that it is leaking some RF energy, the guy next door is going to hear your signal, except for that minor problem. It's a darn nice dummy load. I've done that. I bet you have too, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the 6 amp.
Simon.
KC2WGB, yes, I have been many times. And it is convenient when you want to put a load, and actually what he's doing here, he loads up the antenna, fires up the unit, and he's taking voltage readings, and he didn't want to be on the antenna. And he doesn't want to buy a dummy load. He's doing it very frugally, so that's good news, and I'm sure he'll enjoy hearing that. Okay, Dick, I'm back to you, and I guess we can go to Paul.
You want to make a comment on this one, Russ? Go ahead.
Very much depends on the modulation. You have a HF on the tube amplifier, and then you use a single sidebump. The tube is taking rest in between the processor when you talk. When you run FM, constant. So at that point, it's like you press the key and you keep it on. Do you agree with that? That's it.
Yes, if you're testing an FM transmitter or a Morse code transmitter key down, the light bulb is a beautiful load. And you're absolutely right. AM, by the way, is still a beautiful load because full 100% modulation AM is only 50% higher power than unmodulated AM. So that's a very minor difference. In single sideband, when you go from not talking into the microphone, where in theory a well-balanced sideband transmitter puts out no power at all, and then when you shout into the microphone, you're putting out full power, yes, your light bulb is now going on and off. The light bulb is going from a very low resistance to a much higher resistance, and therefore it's not a steady-state load. Their life's a little bit more complicated. A tube amplifier will tolerate that with no problem. A solid-state amplifier with an antenna tuner, light bulb as a load on a sideband transmitter or a solid-state transmitter, it is a little more dicey. You got a good point. A tube amplifier will tolerate that with no problem. A solid-state amplifier with an antenna tuner, light bulb as a load on a sideband transmitter or a solid-state transmitter, it is a little more dicey. You got a good point. A tube amplifier will tolerate that with no problem. A solid-state amplifier with an antenna tuner, light bulb as a load on a sideband transmitter or a solid-state transmitter, it is a little more dicey. You got a good point. A tube amplifier will tolerate that with no problem. A solid-state amplifier with an antenna tuner, light bulb as a load on a sideband transmitter or a solid-state transmitter, it is a little more dicey. You got a good point. A tube amplifier will tolerate that with no problem. A solid-state amplifier with an antenna tuner, light bulb as a load on a sideband transmitter or a solid-state transmitter, it is a little more dicey. You got a good point. A tube amplifier will tolerate that with no problem. A solid